What do you do when the God you worship is used to justify your enslavement? When the church doors slam shut because your skin is the wrong color? You create something entirely new. For over two centuries, the Black Church has been America's most revolutionary institution, not just a place of worship, but a political headquarters, an underground railroad station, a school, a recording studio, and the birthplace of movements that transformed the nation. When Denmark Vesey plotted rebellion in 1822, he did so from Charleston's AME church pulpit. When Dr. King needed comfort during the movement's darkest hours, he'd call Mahalia Jackson at 2 a.m. to sing gospel over the phone. This wasn't just religion, it was survival, resistance, and the audacious claim that Black humanity mattered when America insisted otherwise. Enslaved Africans didn't arrive as blank slates waiting to be written upon. They brought entire worlds with them, Igbo, Mandinka, Fulbe, Congo spiritual traditions that would quietly reshape American Christianity. Remarkably, up to 20% practiced Islam. Bilali Mohammed managed a Georgia plantation while maintaining his Muslim faith, eventually buried with his prayer rugs and Quran. His grandsons later founded the first African Baptist church, a perfect snapshot of how faiths blended under slavery's brutal pressure. White slaveholders tried weaponizing Jesus, preaching meekness and obedience, but enslaved people saw something different in Christ's story, a man who suffered like them and rose from the dead. They created the invisible institution, secret worship spaces in cabins and by riversides where they could praise freely. South Carolina had made it illegal to teach enslaved people to read or gather after the Stono Rebellion, yet faith gatherings persisted. As one historian noted, in the secrecy of the quarters, the slaves made Christianity truly their own. They transformed the religion of their oppressors into a theology of liberation. Picture Philadelphia's St. George's Methodist Church in 1792. Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, both free Black men, are pulled from their knees during prayer and told to move to the segregated gallery. They walk out, not from wounded pride, but as a declaration of independence. Jones founded the African Episcopal Church of St. Thomas. Allen established Bethel Church, won legal independence after battling white Methodists, and founded the African Methodist Episcopal Church in 1816. Within 6 years, the AME Church claimed 10,000 members. New York's Black Methodists formed AME Zion in 1821, home to Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Tubman. These churches emerged because people refused to worship on their knees in more ways than one. Even here, women faced barriers. When Jerina Lee asked to preach, Richard Allen refused until witnessing her powerful impromptu exhortation. He named her the AME Church's first woman preacher in 1819, though official ordination didn't come until 2016. Denmark Vesey embodied slaveholders' deepest fears. A freedman and lay preacher at Charleston's massive AME congregation, he taught people to read and write, illegal in South Carolina, and in 1822 allegedly planned an uprising to flee to Haiti. Vesey and 35 others were executed, their church demolished. The message? Independent Black religious thought was dangerous. Nat Turner went further. This enslaved Virginia preacher's visions led him to organize an 1831 rebellion, killing as many as 60 whites, exposing how fragile the South's civilizing mission narrative truly was. The abolitionist movement fractured over tactics. At the 1843 National Negro Convention, Frederick Douglass advocated working within the system, while Henry Highland Garnet urged slaves to strike for your lives and liberties. The 1850 Fugitive Slave Act convinced even Douglass that action, action was necessary. When the Civil War erupted in 1861, Black Christians saw their exodus moment arriving. As General Sherman marched to the sea, thousands of freed slaves followed. In Savannah, spokesperson Garrison Frazier articulated their primary need. The way we can best take care of ourselves is to have land. Sherman responded with Special Field Order No. 15, allocating 400,000 acres in 40-acre parcels. By June 1865, 40,000 Black people had settled this Sherman land. Then President Andrew Johnson reversed it all, returning land to former Confederates. Without land, freed people built institutions. Churches came first. When the Navy captured the Sea Islands in 1861, Brick Baptist Church transformed overnight. One Sunday, Brick Baptist was white. The next Sunday, it was black. It soon housed the Penn School, the first Southern school for formerly enslaved people. With nearly 95% of freed people unable to read, black churches established schools that evolved into HBCUs. Morehouse from Springfield Baptist's basement, Spelman from Friendship Baptist, Wilberforce becoming America's first black-owned university. Learning to read the Bible was learning to read freedom into existence. The 15th Amendment granted black men voting rights in 1870, and churches became political headquarters. About 2,000 black men held public office during Reconstruction, including at least 243 ministers. Richard Harvey Kane, pastor of Mother Emanuel in Charleston, became the first black clergyman in Congress in 1872. Black progress triggered white rage. When Reconstruction ended in 1877, former Confederates systematically disenfranchised black voters, targeting churches as symbols of independence. Under Jim Crow, the church became a nation within a nation, handling educational, social, economic, and political needs through financial independence. The National Baptist Convention, formed in 1895, claimed 2.2 million members by 1906 and nearly 3 million by 1916, making it America's third largest religious body. Between World War I and 1970, 6 million African Americans fled north. Established congregations embraced respectability politics, rejecting Southern worship as too spontaneous. This birthed storefront churches where migrants could express themselves musically and religiously most freely. Progressive churches like Chicago's Olivet Baptist adopted the social gospel Christianity, addressing social problems through biblical principles, growing to 5,000 to 10,000 members in what historians call the beginnings of the megachurch movement. Abyssinian Baptist offered practical education because, as much as people think of the North as the promised land, it was hell up here too. This cultural clash also created race records, dramatic 3-minute sermons bringing Southern worship sounds to urban apartments. Gospel music emerged from cultural fusion, blending spirituals, hymns, and blues. Thomas A. Dorsey, formerly blues musician Georgia Tom, became gospel's father, collaborating with Mahalia Jackson, whose 1947 recording, Move On Up a Little Higher, marked the genre's golden age. Jackson's influence transcended music. She funded freedom rides and King's travels. When King struggled, even at 2 a.m., he'd call for her voice. The Freedom Singers, founded in 1962 by SNCC organizers, raised $50,000 while spreading movement songs nationwide. Gospel artists like Shirley Caesar combined musical ministry with pastoral work and political engagement, serving on Durham City Council. Martin Luther King Jr. always traveled with Howard Thurman's Jesus and the Disinherited, which urged people to master the force, the power of love. When the National Baptist Convention refused to endorse direct action protests, King's allies formed the Progressive National Baptist Convention in 1961. The 1963 Birmingham church bombing killed 4 young girls, galvanizing support for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. By 1965, the Voting Rights Act was signed, but King recognized implementation remained crucial. He expanded his activism to oppose the Vietnam War and champion economic justice through the Poor People's Campaign. His 1968 assassination in Memphis left the black church at a crossroads. King's assassination plunged black communities into their deepest crisis since Reconstruction. Young activists abandoned church-led movements for militant groups like the Black Panther Party. In 1969, AME minister James Halcone's Black Theology and Black Power declared white theology irrelevant to black people, arguing God is metaphorically black because God sides with the oppressed. Internal contradictions plagued the church. Though Vashti Murphy McKenzie became an AME bishop in 2000, sexism persisted. Womanist theology emerged to address black women's triple oppression: race, sex, and class. LGBTQ plus Christians found refuge in churches like Oakland's Love Center after years of marginalization. The HIV/AIDS crisis exposed stark divisions. Some denominations condemned victims, while others mobilized compassionate care. As the Black middle class grew, pastors like T.D. Jakes championed entrepreneurship and wealth building, highlighting that Black families earn just $57.30 for every $100 white families make. These tensions, tradition versus progress, prophetic witness versus prosperity gospel, exclusion versus inclusion, revealed a church wrestling with its soul. Barack Obama's 2008 campaign embraced Black church themes, though controversy erupted over his pastor Jeremiah Wright's viral sermon. Despite Obama's presidency, police violence persisted. Eric Garner's 2014 death and Michael Brown's shooting sparked Black Lives Matter, led significantly by women who rejected traditional church models. In 2015, white supremacist Dylan Roof murdered 9 at Mother Emmanuel AME Church Denmark Vesey's historic congregation. Obama's eulogy culminated in him singing Amazing Grace, a powerful moment bridging the Black church's past and present struggles.